today. Is Donald Trump trying to rig November's election?
Good evening, everybody.
It was a Democratic National Convention, and President Barack Obama was giving his big keynote speech.
I'm in Philadelphia, where our Constitution was drafted and signed. It wasn't a perfect document.
He made a speech from the Museum to the History of the U.S. Constitution in Philadelphia, which is where the Constitution was drafted and signed. So it was a kind of symbolic location. Behind him was a facsimile of the Constitution itself.
But embedded in this document was a North Star that would guide future generations. A system of representative government, a democracy, through which we could better realize our highest ideals.
It was a striking speech because, you know, we're used to Obama on the campaign trail being very sort of out there, very ebullient, very rhetorical. On this occasion, he was very restrained. He was almost somber. And what he said was extremely worrying.
Because that's what's at stake right now. Our democracy. This president and those in power, those who benefit from keeping things the way they are counting on your cynicism. They know they can't win you over with their policies. So they're hoping to make it as hard as possible for you to vote and to convince you that your vote does not matter. That is how they win. That is how they get to keep making decisions that affect your life and the lives of the people you love.
And the killer line that he came up with was,
that's how a democracy withers.
He used the word withers, which I thought was pretty powerful.
Until it's no democracy at all.
He was telling the American people that, in his opinion, we were in a place of danger in terms of how democracy functions in the United States.
And we cannot let that happen. Do not let them take away your power. Do not let them take away your democracy.
Some people would say, Barack Obama would say that, wouldn't he? He and Donald Trump have no love lost between them. But that's where things start to get interesting, I think, because Obama was just articulating something that we're now starting to hear more and more people say, people who are not party political, who are not partisan, and who really know what they're talking about. These are the experts in election law, election history, constitutional law and history. And they're all saying exactly the same thing, that democracy in America is in peril.
The Guardian US's chief reporter, Ed Pilkington, has been speaking to some of the country's most prominent figures across civil rights, the law, and academia. What they told him has left him questioning the state of democracy in America. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, will the US election be fair? Ed, you've embarked on what I imagine is quite a daunting reporting project, trying to survey the health of one of the biggest and oldest democracies in the world. Democracy itself is such a huge idea. There are elements of it that are really quite abstract, and then other aspects that are quite concrete. Let's start with those practical examples. Who did you talk to about that?
Okay, let's go. Turn on the voice memo now.
Yes, please.
We're off to the races.
I began by talking to Michael Waldman. Now, he's president of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's Law School, a fount of knowledgeable and authoritative information about how elections function in America. I asked Michael to take me on a sort of quick tour of America to show me what has been happening.
There's voter suppression of many different types and flavors all over the country.
Some of it is actually historical, although it still goes on today. For instance,
17 million people were purged from the voter rolls in the most recent two-year study the Brennan Center did. A lot of them eligible.
This is happening often in Republican-controlled states, and the argument that Republicans put forward is they say there are a lot of dead people on the list, there are a lot of non-citizens who are not entitled to vote are on the list. But actually, when people like Brennan have come to study those who have been purged, they found that a lot of people who are entitled to vote are being scrubbed off.
And that's something you say has been happening for some time. What new things are you seeing this year?
It's partly the pandemic. You know, with the pandemic on, it's going to be very difficult for people to vote safely in person. And we're seeing in a lot of states, polling stations are closing. And we've been seeing in recent primary elections, very, very long lines with people having to queue for hours before they get the chance to vote.
But it's not everybody who has to wait on long lines. Black people and Latino people statistically wait on many longer lines than white people do in the United States. White voters have, generally speaking, an easy time voting. You have misinformation and increasingly intimidation at the polls. For a long time, people have threatened to sort of send vigilantes to the polls to make it so other people can't vote. But recently, a court order was lifted that for the first time allows the Trump campaign to send in people to basically make it harder for other people to vote in person.
For the first time in 40 years, the Republican National Committee, which is the Republican Party at a national level, is going to be free of legal restrictions that have were put down in the 1980s, which prevented them from sending poll watchers to kind of monitor the polls. They're called poll watchers, that's the official term. But, you know, there are suspicions that in many cases they are kind of vigilantes who go there to intimidate people and sort of scare them off actually going through with the voting process. Now, no one knows if that's going to happen, and it may well not happen, but already the Republican National Committee, the National Party, is talking about sending 50,000 poll watchers to the polls in November. And so people are watching that very closely. And finally, there's this extraordinary kerfuffle over the post office. With the pandemic, obviously, people are trying to vote in large numbers in this election by mail. It makes sense. You don't have to go to the polling station. You don't put your health at risk. Donald Trump has been actively and openly, and this is by his own admission, been undermining the post office, trying to withhold funding from the post office in order to hold back large numbers of voting by mail. For some reason, he thinks that if there's a surge in voting by mail, it will go against him.
The president of the United States, admittedly doing everything he can, including choking off essential support for the United States Postal Service in order to prevent people from casting their ballot. Shame on him. Shame on him.
Today, President Trump, with zero evidence, claimed that the election will be an embarrassment and a catastrophe because of vote by mail, while his Postmaster General was elsewhere stating the exact opposite in congressional testimony. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a Trump donor, attempted to calm...
They've even been removing post-sorting machines from postal facilities.
This morning, NBC News has obtained exclusive new images of dismantled mail sorting machines, this time in a facility in Dallas, Texas. Workers there tried to fix and reinstall these machines, but found key parts were missing. It's the latest example of postal workers taking matters into their own hands as the controversy over recent changes within the Postal Service doesn't appear to be slowing down. And it also comes hours after that contentious hearing with Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. He defended those changes and doubled down on his decision not to restore those mail sorting machines.
And in some cases, removing post boxes from the streets in key states in order to put new hurdles in the way of voting by mail.
Do we know that that's why they're doing it?
Well, one thing about Donald Trump is that he does say things openly that politicians in the past may have thought, for all we know, but try to keep hidden. He He said two things that were very suggestive. First off, he said he was withholding extra funding for the post office because he didn't want there to be more money going into voting by mail.
They want $3.5 billion for the mail-in votes. Okay, universal mail-in ballots. They want $25 billion for the post office. Now, they need that money in order to have the post office work so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots. By the way, those are just two items. But if they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting.
And the second thing that he said was that he said that if the levels of funding to the post office increased to the extent that you would have a surge in voting.
Levels of voting that if you ever agreed to it, you'd never have a Republican elected in this country again.
You'd never have a Republican elected in this country again.
And more than once, you've pointed out that this sort of action doesn't land equally on voters across the country. How disproportionately is this affecting African Americans?
Well, ever since the founding of the nation, the African American vote has been a huge sore spot within this imperfect democracy. In the days of Jim Crow and the segregated South, you had to actually be able to recite the preamble to the US Constitution if you were going to get registered to vote as a black person. And so this stuff is very far from new, but there is a feeling that in this cycle it's reaching a new level, a new intensity. And Derek Johnson, who is a very prominent figure in the current civil rights movement in America, he's the president of the NAACP. He talked to me about how something that had begun as a Southern issue had now gone national.
In many ways, what used to be a regional problem in the South, primarily, has become a national critical issue. It is all type of ways that individuals seek to suppress African-American votes. Elimination of polling places in African-American communities. When you eliminate polling places, you cause longer lines in other communities where there are precincts. In Georgia, for example, we had polling places that opened with the machines and have the necessary power cords. We had to file a lawsuit to extend the hours that the precinct would be open. There's been a huge uptick in efforts to misdirect, mislead, or outright suppress the right of African Americans to cast a ballot for this election cycle. And we have not seen this level of intentional overt exclusion since the 50s and mid 60s.
And democracy is about more than what you've just told me about. It's about more than the voting system, isn't it? What other ways did you find that democracy was being undermined?
Well, and I think it also might be worth saying at this point, before we go into it, that the threat to democracy is more than Donald Trump. But, you know, we are here with the re-election bid of Donald Trump, and he is very, very present. And one of the major things that he's been doing is that he's been trying to undermine credibility in this election.
Trump is already trying to discredit the election in advance. I guess that counts as planning ahead. He's already said it's rigged. He's already said that it's the most corrupt election in American history, which I always think somewhere Richard Nixon's ghost is scowling at that idea that his honor would be taken away from him.
In 78 days, we're going to stop the radical left. We're going to win the state of Wisconsin, and we are going to win four more years. And then after that, we'll go for another 4 years because, you know what, they spied on my campaign. We should get a redo of 4 years. Just make sure your vote gets counted. Make sure, because the only way we're going to lose this election is if the election is rigged. Remember that.
He said that voting by mail will lead to an outpouring of fraud in the result. He's essentially said that this election is illegitimate. Well, you turn to the people who are experts in this area, who have done the number crunching, have actively looked for fraud and tried to find it. And yes, you can find isolated instances all around the country at any election, but they are isolated and they are minusculely small in number.
voter fraud is vanishingly rare in the United States, as every study shows over and over again. As a statistical matter, you are more likely to be struck by lightning than to commit voter fraud. That's true for vote by mail. It's certainly true for in-person voting. This is a time-tested scare tactic that is used by politicians who are trying to cling to power. We should see it as an illegitimate method of running an election.
Does this matter, though? I mean, it's Trump's rhetoric. How damaging is it really?
Well, it matters if people believe him. And we're seeing in the polls that out of nowhere, from zero, now three quarters of Republican voters think that voting by mail is fraudulent and cannot be believed. And, you know, if you plant those seeds into people's minds of millions of Americans, I think that does matter. Even if he loses, that seed has been planted for maybe up to, you know, arguably 60 million Americans who will carry it with them. They will nurture it. They will feel, you know, begrudging about it. And who knows what the long-term consequences of that feeling of bitterness will be.
So what you're basically saying is the Republicans are trying to change the mechanics of the election in their favor, but they've got this kind of backup option, which is if that doesn't work, they just cast out over the whole thing.
Yeah, and you know, remarkably, we saw Donald Trump do that even when he won the election in 2016. If you remember, he won it by the Electoral College vote. He lost it by 3 million votes to Hillary Clinton on the popular vote. And he then went off on a complete conspiracy theory. He said 3 million non-citizens had voted illegally with zero evidence that that had happened.
And he is also suggesting that if he doesn't win, he might not leave office. Is that even possible?
It's worrying. I'm not sure it's possible, but he is certainly capable of causing a lot of trouble.
The question people ask is, well, what if Trump doesn't accept the results? I think it's the wrong question. It's not up to him to accept the results, and we're falling into his royalist mindset if we think it matters whether he accepts the results or not. It's whether the rest of us accept the results. The problem is there's a lot of opportunities for mischief after the election, depending on how close it is, because we have this antiquated system that was still largely designed by people wearing powdered wigs. There are open questions about, well, what if the legislature of a state says one candidate won, but the governor says another candidate won?
You know, we know for already that the election result is likely to be delayed for several days, even weeks, as a result of the pandemic and large numbers of people voting by mail, and that always takes longer to count. So there could easily be an interim period. We might even see Trump vastly ahead on election night with people who vote in person, but go on to lose down the road because of all those vote by mail ballots that take time to be counted. And in that interim period, he has already primed himself and has said as much to cause a lot of difficulty. They are amassing an army of lawyers who will be ready in place come November the 4th, the day after the election. This could become a very, very bitter, very toxic legal fight.
What you've set out seems pretty extreme, right from the mechanical elements of how you might disrupt or distort an election through rhetoric and right up to the idea of a president even refusing to accept the result. And all of it comes from people who are hugely respected in their fields and making really quite strong points. But some in the Republican Party would argue that people in academia and those representing civil society tend to think in a more liberal way. And liberals are quite alarmed by the Donald Trump presidency. How confident are you that all the views you heard were nonpartisan views?
I think that's a very reasonable and very good question. All the people I spoke to are clear they are nonpartisan. However, It's also the case that in recent times, and we're talking about the last 10 or 20 years, the main threat to democracy in America, whether it's in the form of voter suppression or undermining confidence in the election process itself, has come from the Republican Party. There's an asymmetry here, which means that their focus is largely on the Republican Party. And I think you can't get away from that. I don't think it undermines what they're saying to us.
Coming up, has democracy always been a fiction for some Americans? Everything we've spoken about so far is really about what happens on the 3rd of November and immediately afterwards. But it seems to me that this is about much more than an election. Democracy is about the way in which a country is run, and it's about its institutions, isn't it?
Absolutely. Democracy is much, much wider than Election Day. In America, it's we the people, those opening words of the US Constitution. It's about taking the will of the people and making it manifest in government.
And did you speak to people about these areas?
Absolutely. I to some extent, this is how this whole project that we've been doing at The Guardian began. It began with a woman called Deirdre Schifling.
My name is Deirdre Schifling, and I am the founder and campaign director of a democracy reform campaign called Democracy for All 2021.
And her journey was a few years ago. She was working as the head of the advocacy arm of Planned Parenthood, which is the largest reproductive health services provider in the US. She found herself thinking about how, on the one hand, you have public opinion in America, which is quite clear on the issue of, say, abortion rights. And on the other hand, you have a largely, again, it's asymmetrical, a largely Republican group in Congress that is increasingly hostile to a woman's right to choose.
This is a country that, 75% of our country believes that Roe v. Wade was correctly decided. So this sort of fundamental ruling on women's access to abortion, women's access to reproductive decision making, this is not actually contested in public opinion. It's a small minority of people who fundamentally disagree with that.
She spent her life beating back attacks on abortion rights in states across the country.
My team spent an enormous amount of time on the defense, trying to push back on, 6-week abortion bans, trying to push back on bills that would imprison healthcare providers that provide abortion, even though this is supposed to be a constitutional right in our country. Push back on bills that would ban access to birth control. Just all kinds of crazy things. And what that's resulted in is a loss of access in several states in our country, functionally.
So many impediments have been put in the way of having an abortion that it's virtually impossible to go through with it. I mean, if the US Supreme Court says abortion is legal and constitutional in America, but you can't get an abortion if you're living in certain states around the country, then something is going seriously wrong.
We do also have to remember that this is the year in which we saw that huge uprising for Black Lives Matter, an uprising that was obviously triggered by the death of George Floyd, but that was about so much more than that incident. Floyd was a symbol of injustice, and the injustice felt by Black Americans is about a lack of voice and a lack of representation. And despite even that huge movement, it doesn't feel as if anyone is listening. Couldn't you argue that for this huge group of Americans and others, democracy is already broken?
I think you put that extremely well. And it goes back to our point that democracy is not just about Election Day. It's about being represented. It's about being respected. It's about, having the right to leave your house and not be fearful that a police officer will assault you for no reason. It's about being a full and fully respected participant in your country's democracy. I talked to Sabil Rahman, who is the head of Demos, the think tank Demos in the US, he talked to me about how before Trump, but even more so now, for so many black and brown Americans, there's a real feeling that they're not really living in a democracy at all.
How would you describe a regime where one set of constituents are actively targeted by state violence from the police, from immigration enforcement, from Homeland Security, where economically they have a tiny fraction of the wealth that white Americans have? I raise all that to say that part of what we're grappling with in this moment is that actually democracy has been a fiction for many Americans for forever, and we're having to come to terms with that.
And rather than try to address some of the concerns raised by protesters, if we look at Donald Trump's words and actions in Kenosha or Portland, things that we have covered in recent episodes, isn't he compounding that sense of disenfranchisement, even taking advantage of it?
Yes, I think this is the most sort of viscerally disturbing part of this whole story, are the images we're seeing coming out of cities around the country where Trump has been actively whipping up vigilantism, really, and also using his power as the executive in this country to do some very, very sort of distressing visual things, like, you know, sending in largely border patrol agents dressed in military desert camouflage to go and police protests in Portland. The smoke bombs and the camouflaged officers wearing gas masks. I mean, you know, they were chilling. Again, you can't get away from thinking of that word authoritarian, a word that none of us expected to be associating with the American democracy. The strategy is could not be clearer, and that is you stoke up violence, and when trouble happens on the streets, you use that as an electoral ploy. So you then turn around and say Joe Biden is responsible for all this, even though it's happening under Trump's watch. And you say it's a Democratic mayor of whatever town it's happening in who's not doing enough to clamp down on the protesters. And again, it's a direct attack on democratic principles. It's using your power as president in order to give yourself an electoral advantage at whatever cost.
You've set out a long list of ways in which democracy in America is being undermined, from things that are quite practical and specifically linked to this election and the way it's being conducted, to more fundamental questions about how society works. And you've said that there's an imbalance here, and the Republican Party has been responsible for a lot of this under Trump, but also for many years before he took power. From everything you've heard, have you got an understanding of why they would be doing that?
I'll just fling a few statistics at you, because I think in short order, they tell you the whole story. In 1984, when Ronald Reagan was re-elected, 87% of registered voters were white. On November the 3rd, when we go to the polls here in America, that figure will have fallen to 67%, a drop of 20 points. And by 2045, the US is projected to have become minority white. In other words, there will be fewer white voters than the combined number of Latino, Black, Asian, and other minority voters. And I think therein lies the story, really. The Republican Party, up to now, has put their chips into retaining what power they have, into doubling down on their white base. We see that in the policies that they pursue. We see that in the language that they adopt. And above all, we see that in Donald Trump, whose base is overwhelmingly white. And they've done that rather than try and develop a wider tent and to appeal to minority groups. Part of their calculation is that they need to make it harder for non-white groups of Americans to vote. All those tactics that we've been discussing, they kind of require to bolster their white voter approach and hang on to power.
I mean, when I hear you say that, I think how short-termist is that? Because as you say, eventually that demographic change is going to overwhelm any alleged attempts to rig the election.
It's astonishing, really astonishing. After 2012, after the defeat of Mitt Romney to Barack Obama in his second presidential election campaign, the Republican Party did a post-mortem, a huge post-mortem. They came up with a very large and detailed report that said that the party needed to change tack and open itself up to other voting populations and communities within America. What happened next? Donald Trump.
Maybe things will change organically in the longer term, but in the shorter term, doesn't this pose almost a catch-22 for the opposition? That in order to change any of this, the Democratic Party has to win under this system, and it's a system in which the cards are being increasingly stacked against them.
Yes, at its darkest, I think America is faced with a real catch-22 problem, which is, you know, people are very, very clear about what needs to be reformed in this country to make the electoral system and make the democracy in its widest sense work better. But you can't get to make any of those changes because the system isn't working. It's going to be very, very difficult to see a way out of that hole that the country is in. Having said that, we saw in 2008, Barack Obama won all three parts of the political process. And on the back of that, he pushed through Obamacare. It is conceivable that Joe Biden might do the same again. And then there is a chance for the Democratic Party to start pushing through some major electoral reforms. They already have a huge bill on the table. It's called HR1. It deals with a lot of what we've been talking about. It allows for automatic registration for votes so that you can't try and suppress the vote. It gives representation for Washington, D.C. and for Puerto Rico, who are currently cut out. And it restores federal controls against any state that is trying to play silly games with elections. One has to wait and watch and just see what happens, because it could go either way. And as all the people I spoke to said, they all apologized for it before saying it, because it sounds like such a cliche, that the stakes could not be higher on November the 3rd, and that the very future of this country was resting on it.
That was Ed Pilkington, chief reporter at Guardian US, who has written all about this. Go to theguardian.com for more from all his interviews. For his piece, he spoke to Michael Waldman, head of the Brennan Center for Justice, Derek Johnson, president of the NAACP, Deirdre Schiefling, campaign director of Democracy for All 2021, Sabeel Rahman, head of Demos, and Vinita Gupta, president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and Obama's former head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. My thanks to all of them and to Ed Pilkington. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.